Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Unheard's Christmas special. Yes, we are a few days before Christmas, and that's why we're sitting here in a specially designed set at the Unheard Club. We have a Christmas tree behind us. I'm wearing my traditional velvet Christmas outfit, as are our guests. We are 100% in velvet. And we've also chosen to break the space-time continuum by Florence and myself both presenting this week's episode. So that's a world first.
It is. We've been seen in the same room for the first time ever.
We actually both exist. And our topic, unsurprisingly, is Christmas. Because you might think that Christmas is a time of peace and plenty. Your visions might be of sort of cherubic choir boys walking down the aisle of some cathedral to the tune of Once in Royal David City. No. Our guest today has a very different view of what the essence of Christmas is, and looking across the ages at the history of Christmas is going to present us with an alternative thesis. So prepare to forget everything you think you know about the festival we're about to enjoy, and let's learn something new. Flo.
Tom Hodgkinson is the editor of the Idler magazine, and he is in fact my former employer. I had many good years working at the Idler, and he joins us to tell us a little bit about the chaotic origins of the Christmas festival. But first, before it was Christmas, it wasn't Christmas, was it? It was something else entirely.
Christmas means a mass to celebrate the birth of Christ. Well, we know that. That's what the word Christmas means. It's a midwinter festival. I think that's the sort of key thing about it. And in countries where it's very cold in midwinter, it's actually a very natural thing and an ancient idea to have a big party. It's a time of no work. It's a time when you can't go out into the field, you can't plough, you can't harrow, you know. And it's cold outside. So the traditions that we have at Christmas are, in fact, basically sort of ancient. And they're common to many,
Pre-Christian.
Pre-Christian, certainly, yeah. I mean, the famous Roman festival, midwinter festival, was Saturnalia. And it has other features of Christmas that we enjoy too, which is that order is sort of turned upside down. So the Saturnalian feasts involved, you know, elevating a slave to be king for a day and this sort of thing. Very sort of playful. So when you see, you know, sometimes people are a bit kind of snooty about the sort of drunken guy walking down Oxford Street, you know, tie askew with a pair of antlers on his head, you know. So that's not really the spirit of Christmas. That really is, you know, that sort of drunkenness. Letting the real world go, a long break from work, you know. And so this Saturnalia and all sorts of ancient midwinter feasts and festivals sort of morph into the Christian Christmas, because some academics anyway reckon that the church elders thought, well, this is a kind of, this is happening anyway, so let's kind of appropriate it and mix it in with the birth of Christ. And that's why you get this kind of quite strange mix of, you know, pagan symbolism. Father Christmas has got a sort of green man sort of quality, you know, and he was originally a sort of green man, like a sort of elf spirit or spirit of the woods, mixed in with, you know, conventional sort of piety and Christian worship.
So Saturnalia, just to do a bit of a kind of chronological sweep through this, Saturnalia, is that different then from midsummer festivals, from the kind of Bacchanalia, kind of feasting? What is Saturnalia?
And well, it's very similar to all of those, I think. I mean, I'm not a sort of thorough expert, but you know, going back to Greek times, in fact, all ancient civilizations had lots and lots of feast days and holidays, and there were religious societies. So there were days set aside for praying to the gods, and then there would be a sort of feast at the end. And I think about the feast they have at the end of Asterix, you know, when the battle's done, you know, and there's a sort of massive feast. And this is written about, obviously, in Homer, and Ovid, I think, wrote a book called Festi and Fasti, which is about the feast days and the holy days, festivals and fasts. So these are actually pre-Christian ideas. And Saturnalia, I think, was around the 23rd of December. And of course, the other obvious thing to say is it's about the shortest day of the year, isn't it? So I think the solstice is around 21st, 22nd.
So there was a kind of chaotic, you're saying the slave would be appointed a kind of temporary king. It's like an inversion of the normal order. That's what we're supposed to feel at the darkest day of the year.
Exactly right, yeah. So just for one day, or for possibly a few days, I mean, 12 days of Christmas, you know, we might come back to that, but in medieval times, you really did take 12 days off for Christmas, unless you were the cook.
So I guess at the Idler, you support bringing back the full 12 days?
We certainly do, yeah. But it has almost come back kind of its own accord, hasn't it? Because we do get this sort of extended holiday, because it sort of morphs into the New Year holiday, which is another thing.
Perhaps we could talk about the Danes a little bit, because they imported by force a different Christmas tradition when they invaded. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I compared that slightly to the recent Danish trend of hygge, which is the trend of staying inside, gathering around a candle and everything being sort of simple and quiet at Christmas. It's all the same sort of thing, really, isn't it? You know, Virgil said, you know, winter is the farmer's lazy time. So the Danes, I think, had the word Yule, and there was the idea of the Yule log, which is an enormous log that you sort of bung on the fire, which burns and burns and burns, and that was incorporated into later Christmas traditions. And then we sort of move into the European medieval Christmas, and the word merry, which I think is such a lovely word, and it's not very often used in everyday parlance, apart from next to the word Christmas, you know, generally nowadays.
Generally means drunken as well.
And generally, it does mean a bit merry, it means a little bit drunk.
Out of control, you might say.
And out of control a bit. It's a very, very common word in Shakespeare. I looked it up in the concordance, and it's like it crops up like 200 or 300 times in Shakespeare plays, the word merry. But the medieval Christmas, you get a wonderful sort of image of certainly the kind of Christmas that the posh people would have had in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And there, you know, Christmas does go on for a full 12 days or even longer, and the lords and the ladies give themselves over to dancing and games and pleasure and fun and being silly. So the sort of inversion that we were talking about earlier, you know, the slave is king for a day and that sort of thing. Everything's upside down. You know, it's a time for silly games and prancing.
Let me just read the quote here. You've given us a quote from a kind of modern translation of Gawain and the Green Knight. For there the feast was alike full 15 days, with all the meat and mirth men could devise, such clamour and glee glorious to hear, dear din in the daylight, dancing of knights, all was happiness high in halls and chambers with lords and ladies. So that's the Christmas vibe in, what is Gawain and the Green Knight? I don't know.
I think it's 14th century.
Yeah. So it's a party.
It's a party. I think it's a bit just before Chaucer, I think. By the way, it's extremely well read, Freddie.
Thank you.
And isn't it a lovely poem, the alliteration in it? Makes it sound a bit like sort of Gerald Manley Hopkins or something. I think it actually sounds quite modern to me, the way it's written. But and I forgot it was 15 days, the Christmas then. So
even longer than we've got now.
Even longer than we've got now.
So would they have thrown the doors open, these kind of aristocratic figures, the lords and ladies? Would they have invited people from the towns into that home?
Yeah, and this is another pre-Reformation, because we're going to come on to that in a moment, because Christmas has undergone vicious, severe and violent attacks over the last 500 or 600 years.
But
the pre-Reformation Christmas was also about charity, you know, which it still is, looking after the poor. And Thomas Tusser, who wrote a kind of late medieval or Tudor sort of guide to gardening, he said that at Christmas time, everyone, you know, rich people throw open their doors, in medieval times, there was actually less separation between servants and masters. There wasn't a sort of Downton Abbey thing, upstairs, downstairs.
Got a quote here, just going to come in with that. This is Thomas Tusser, who you mentioned. At Christmas we banquet the rich with the poor, who then but the miser but openeth his door. So that's sort of, it's both things, isn't it? It's the inversion, but also the charitable aspect. You don't actually hear that much about the charitable aspect these days. There's sort of...
Well, it's been turned into something dark, hasn't it? Now we talk about, when we think about Christmas charity, the appeals are always very, very depressing. Mm. And it sounds like that was about a generosity of spirit rather than feeling sorry for people. You say, look, let's share in this joy rather than, ooh, let's all share in this depression.
Do you know people who are, opening their doors to...
We don't do that much anymore, do we? And the aristocrats were definitely expected to do that, as they would be at, for example, wakes. So everyone could just turn up and get the free handouts, get the booze and the food and the fatted capons and spiced wines and so on, you know, the wassailing or whatever it was. And that was a very genuine feature of pre-Reformation, certainly England, probably, you know, Europe. Because the church, you know, the church, which was obviously very powerful, was preaching charity, caritas, looking after people. It's a form of love, you know, it was a duty, particularly for the rich people. And also, that actually goes back to Romans and Greeks, when the rich people were expected to sort of dole out a lot back into society.
The kind of agape principle.
The agape principle, yeah, one of the sort of Greek words for love.
OK, so do we need to hear about the Reformation now? Are we ready?
Are we ready for the Reformation?
So where have we got up to? Give us a kind of date.
Well, I'm thinking here. About sort of, let's say we're on sort of something like 1500.
Yeah.
So this is about, you know, 70 or 100 years before Shakespeare. Who most of his plays was, you know, I think Twelfth Night was 1601. So that just gives you a kind of rough idea of where we are.
So that's carrying on. Basically, in some way, that same spirit that was inherited from the ancients comes through a kind of early medieval period right up to the early modern.
It is very much there, yeah. And I mean, the historian I get a lot of this from is Ronald Hutton, who's a professor of history at Bristol. And he wrote a book called The Rise and Fall of Merry England. And he says that, you know, people used to think this idea of Merry England was a myth. He says, no, it wasn't a myth, actually, because in this late medieval period, from about 1350 to sort of 1550, roughly, or 1535, just before the Reformation, there actually was a Merry England. And the reason we were merry was because merriment was actually encouraged by the church. Because the church wanted people to sort of bond and get together. They knew it was good for community spirit. There was maypole dancing, lots of days off, lots of feast days, fast days, as we said, a long, long Christmas festival, a long Easter festival. And the church put on the parties and sold the booze to raise money to make more churches. And there was a church building kind of boom.
But so this actually, it's often a kind of complaint that people make of the Protestant versus Catholic difference, isn't it? That you go to a Catholic church, even now, and it can have more of a party atmosphere in that there's multiple generations, there's kids running around, it's noisy, it takes ages. It feels more sort of party-like in a way, even though it can
bells
be
and
very...
Smells.
Bells and smells.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the sense I'm getting is that we're going to be painting the Reformation as a bit of the anti-Christmas spirit. Am I right?
Absolutely, because they saw it as popish. So the Christmas reformers, who are the sort of the modernists of the day, the kind of, you know, the people who would eventually end up as a sort of Cromwellian type, you know, forward thinking, forward moving, were getting rid of this old popish superstition. And they say, so all the maypoles came down. They said they were stinking idle that, you know, got people into sort of mood where they wanted to have sex. And so maypoles were kind of put up by Satan. And Christmas was a satanic festival. I mean, they actually said this. And Christmas, it was completely banned in Scotland. They got there first, the Presbyterians, you know. And you still have that today, that they don't really, you know, New Year's Eve is a much bigger deal for the Scots than Christmas.
So they have a more solemn... Restrained affair
solemn,
in their
restrained,
kirks.
Yeah, so the reformers, you know, the Protestant or Puritan reformers, they said that, you know, medieval Christianity had become hopelessly corrupt, you know, people selling, the monks were, you know, swigging claret and dressed in purple ermine robes or whatever.
So they're still suffering the dour effects of Puritanism even now.
Well, I think we are, you know, and so this sort of battle started. So Christmas was seen as a sort of superstitious, popish, satanic festival that was just like a relic of an ancient time. It was pagan. It was ridiculous. It's like, how could we? It's a bit like we might think about horoscopes. So that's how they saw Christmas, you know, just
A relic of less sophisticated.
Yeah, you know, when we were sort of unscientific and so on and so forth.
Is this, just to be precise, is this the kind of sort of Lutheran first wave, or is this, are we talking about kind of later Puritans? Are we talking about, you know, 1650, 1660?
Well,
Civil
you're right.
War time?
I'm just kind of mixing them together, but yeah, the Reformation is where it sort of starts. You know, in the Reformation, 1535, Henry VIII's soldiers smash up all the churches. All the monks and nuns are turned out into the streets, and the old monasteries are handed to his mates, who are today's aristocrats, earls and lords, you know.
So that was the beginning?
That was the sort of beginning of it, yeah. You know, because people still love celebrating Christmas, and all through the Tudor period, you know, people were still celebrating it. And but some people would, you know, make a big point of keeping their shops open on Christmas Day, for example. You know, I'm not celebrating Christmas. This is, you know, I'm not doing it.
They're taking like a moral stand against Christmas.
Taking a moral stand. But the real crackdown, yeah, as you say, Freddie, came a bit later in a sort of Cromwell period, the interregnum, when it was actually banned.
Christmas was literally cancelled.
Christmas was cancelled, yeah.
Was it illegal?
It was virtually illegal. I mean, it was massively frowned upon.
Did you have to go underground if you were going to
go underground? Yeah. So there were these sort of anti-Christmas, like having a rave, you know, because some people carried on having Christmas parties. And they'll be sort of broken up by the sort of anti-Christmas police of the time.
So the lockdown breakers of Christmas.
It was exactly the same, yeah. And then people still carried on celebrating it. So someone in the House of Lords or the House of Commons complained and stood up and said, "Look, I thought we'd ban Christmas, but I heard a lot of noise last night. You know, people still seem to be celebrating this superstitious popish feast."
So history does really repeat itself.
It really does repeat
over
itself.
Over.
Well, is it almost like we're sort of still there in some? I mean, people talk about cancelling Christmas all the time.
Yeah.
It does feel like, if you're talking about the Cromwell period, mm-hmm. where you have these sort of two very different strands of English mentality, the kind of restrained, severe Puritan side, and then the kind of the Merry England, which occasionally gets submerged, and then, you know, after the Cromwell period, it then kind of came back with Charles II.
Yeah.
Do you think we're basically still having that battle as a culture, as which one is virtuous?
I think that's exactly right. And it may even go even deeper than that, that it's something deep inside the sort of human psyche. There's a kind of a battle between the inner Puritan and the inner sort of merrymaker. You know, you see these battles played out in Twelfth Night. Malvolio represents the Puritan finger wagger. His name obviously means I wish bad. And then Toby Belch's and Maria are part of the old-fashioned medieval culture, which is about cakes and ale, dancing and drinking all night. But also they can be quite cruel. So they were also into bear baiting and cockfighting. The Puritans actually cracked down on bear baiting too, because they said it was cruel to animals. So there are, you know, there's something positive about it. And, you know, and the Puritans were saying, you know, the people are being corrupted. But look at the difference in the singing and the churches. The Protestant churches, think of the ones in the States in the 19th century, very simple. A wooden church, little house on the prairie sort of thing, you know, prim and sort of funless. But yeah, so the Puritans...
It's interesting you do a slight defence of the Puritans there. We had Tom Holland for a previous Christmas special in this very room before it was done up, and he was also making a bit of a defence of Puritans. He thinks they're quite misunderstood, and that actually he quite admires them, and that they were driven by this like true sort of ethic and true desire to be good, which is actually quite admirable. What's the idler position the Puritans?
Yeah, some of the Puritans, look at the Quakers. They were like Puritan stormtroopers, and we sort of quite like Quakers. They made chocolate. They sort of looked after people, and there was a peace loving.
Is that the summit of their accomplishments? Well,
they did oats as well.
They built Bourneville, didn't they? You know, and the Fry Company, and so on and so forth. And also, actually, there's a kind of part of Quakerism, which is very radical and almost anarchist in its pacifism. So Tolstoy was influenced by these Boston anti-war groups. of the sort of early 19th century, for example, and then he went on to influence Gandhi. So there's a sort of funny line there of the extreme Quakers. But there's something, personally, I find even the Quakers a little bit, you know, they're teetotal.
Bit dour,
yeah, you know. And yes, there's lots to be admired about them, and they probably, they wouldn't go cockfighting, they wouldn't, you know, bait bears and so on.
I have a little begrudging kind of respect, though, for this anti-decadent movement that we've got. And maybe it does end in a kind of puritanistic feeling, but, you know, you read things about factory farming, for example, and then you see the George Monbiots or whatever in The Guardian saying, you know, Christmas is a time to go vegan, and it feels, you know, punitive on our pleasure at Christmas. But you look into it and you think, well, there's a point there. There is a kind of moral centre that all of this carnivalesque pleasure seeking, it doesn't have that same moral centre, unless that centre is pleasure.
Yes, but I think you can have both, you know, because it's a short period, perhaps 12 or hopefully 15 days of total licentiousness, and then you go back to work on Plough Monday, as it used to be. The other thing to say about Christmas is that, you know, the modern Christmas was more or less recreated by Dickens.
Just before we get, I've got to just,
okay, sorry,
I want to finish the Civil War here.
Okay, we're still
it's
the
my
Civil War,
kind of Puritan sort of sequential brain. Cannot leap around.
No, too much.
Too much carnival chaos. Let's finish the Civil War. So there were actually riots. Yeah, there was sort of Christmas being cancelled, royalist versus Cromwellian riots going on throughout.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The interregnum, is that right? Or what was happening there?
Yeah, there were these sort of Christmas riots. I don't know what the comparison would be. It was a bit like having raves. Governments are quite sort of naturally puritanical. And some of your viewers and listeners might remember in the 90s, there was a crackdown on raves. And what the bill used a phrase, something like, you know, music characterised by the succession of repetitive beats. And that was a little bit like, the sort of fun-loving, carnivalesque side of us, the bacchanalian, as he called it earlier, Freddie, it revolts against that, you know, and I think that's quite natural. So
do you feel like now, I'm now completely breaking my own rules and just jumping to the present day, do you think now we're in a sort of Puritan period? Or, if there was a riot now, which side would you be on? And do you think the Merry England is currently being suppressed and needs to be released, or do you think there's plenty of it?
It's really hard to say, because we do all still celebrate Christmas, and it's an incredibly sort of powerful idea. I mean, you know, a sort of Puritan or a Protestant prelate in the 1550s would be absolutely amazed that sort of 400 or 500 years later, this ancient pagan superstitious whatever popish festival was still being celebrated. So it's definitely still there. I think there is a sort of puritanical strand in politics, on the left and on the right. So authoritarian strand, the people must be controlled. We mustn't give them this sort of freedom license. You know, Christmas is a sort of period for license. But the sensible cultures, I think, you know, allow this kind of spirit to bubble up every now and then. They don't smash it down. It's a bit like prohibition. You know, that seems like such an amazingly bad idea to us now, doesn't it? But that happened quite recently in the States in the 1930s, and it, you know, alcohol was banned. It was obviously totally backfired.
So actually the kind of controlled release of a 12-day Christmas crazy period is actually sort of might make you more hardworking or more productive in the
exactly, it might do. Yeah, sort of bread and circuses idea.
If both right and left then are becoming more puritanical, what is the kind of political movement pro-Christmas? Is that the libertarian movement?
I suppose it would be a libertarian... There's something about, you know, there's something in the clown king leader, someone like Boris Johnson, which people actually find quite attractive, don't they?
Well, they used to have the King of Misrule, they'd give a crown to, and they'd say, now you're in charge of kind of creating chaos.
Creating chaos. And there's something in us that actually likes that, you know.
That might be the Elon Musks of the world as well.
The clown capitalist.
Yeah.
So the clowns are quite popular, you know. Freddie, you mentioned Charles II, you know, it was quite a relief when he came back to the throne. He had long hair, he had mistresses at his court, he was very Boris-y in a way. I think, you know, he actually had he openly lived with his courtesans like Boris did. And that's quite unusual for a king. Nell Gwynne's the famous one, but there were lots of other ones. And he was called the Merry Monarch. And he had these sort of merry courtiers around him. So I think, I'm personally a fan of, you know, Tories and Boris and stuff, but there is that sort of fun-loving... Maybe there should be a political party which...
The Bacchanalians.
The Bacchanalians.
Boris Johnson could definitely... Rishi Sunak, not
people.
So much.
No, Rishi Sunak is pure Puritan, isn't he?
He's a non-drinking...
He's non-drinking,
restrained.
You know, but there's that party culture in Hinduism too, though, isn't there? Like an absolute explosion of light, Diwali and so on, you know, noise, light, fireworks, shouting.
Maybe he needs to embrace it. A bit more chaos for Rishi.
A bit more chaos. Can you think of any merry politicians? It's a good question.
I have to come back to you on that one, drawing a blank. There's an idea in what you said earlier that I think is really quite important and interesting, which is that these moments of chaos were actually sort of moral in some way. Like the fact that they were connected to charity, the king and the pauper would reverse roles. So it was a sort of, by turning society upside down for a while, you actually kind of mixed things up, made connections that weren't there before, had greater sympathy for people in different positions, possibly literally helping them. Whilst at the moment, I suppose, people would think these kind of more bacchanalian, decadent, crazy times are sort of morally dubious. I don't know, maybe there's thought that needs to be reintroduced that sort of chaos actually goes alongside charity, isn't against it.
It goes hand in hand with charity. That's obviously why the church authorities of the later medieval period embraced it, because they actually saved Freddie, because they knew it was very good for society, it was cohesive, and it brought people together. Charity today is something that you sort of do at arm's length. So you sort of give to a charity and hope that someone else will look after the homeless people. But the aristocrats then were actually inviting the homeless people to have Christmas with them, which is a very, very different thing, isn't it? And I think that was true. I mean, I'm aware I sort of have a slightly rosy view of the Middle Ages, certainly. But there was much more sort of more mixing up of sort of different classes, certainly a lot more social mobility than we think there was. And there was a very, very strong middle class as well. You know, in places like Florence, which are run by the bourgeoisie, the guild members.
So and a fair bit of plague, early death, indentured servitude. I can feel the
well,
cross-liberal now.
It's going on.
Yeah, this is another argument, yeah. Although, you know, when it comes to child mortality and mortality in general, things took a big dip in the 19th century. So there hasn't actually been a sort of steady curve upwards, which is what we often think. Like, the further back you go, the younger people died, and today today people do live longer than they have done before.
That's a beautiful segue to the 19th century, by
the
way. I can't let that
yeah, yeah. Okay,
slide. Because you had wanted to talk about Dickens. You've brought us back to the 19th century.
Well, what's funny, what did Dickens do? Because you don't read that much about Christmas in the 18th century. And Roald Dahl said it wasn't actually a sort of massive deal. I mean, Dr. Johnson doesn't seem to sort of... I think that, you know, it was celebrated, but it wasn't the kind of Christmas that we have today. There was no Christmas tree.
Do you think there was still a hangover from that Puritan moment?
I think it was still must have been a hangover from when it was sort of completely banned. We really have Dickens to thank. A Christmas Carol was published in the 1830s, I think, or 1840s. That's right at the beginning of Victoria's reign. So almost at the end of George IV. And that introduced a whole new idea of Christmas, or I should say reintroduced a very old idea of Christmas. And I think Dickens was quite consciously bringing back the kind of medieval ideas of Christmas and the... Is there a Christmas in Shakespeare? I mean, anyway, but the feeling of sort of merriment and charity, and the attack on the sort of joyless, puritanical, utilitarian creed of Scrooge. Why are you asking me for charity? Can't they go to the poorhouses or whatever he says? You know,
Tiny Tim being in the kind of embodiment of the those children in need, as we've now called them.
Exactly.
Should we do a quote from... You've got a quote here from A Christmas Carol, which is the anarchic chaos of the Fezziwigs. Flo?
The Fezziwigs are my favourite Dickens family. I think they are rotund, jolly, merry. They embody merriment, truly.
They were Mr. Fezziwig was Scrooge's boss when he was young, I think. And then he's remembering this Christmas, which must have been pre-Victorian, actually. So there must have been a Christmas
nostalgia.
Tradition. Yeah.
Well, the Fezziwigs were early adopters of the Dickensian
the
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
So this is them. In came a fiddler with a music book and went up to the lofty desk and made an orchestra of it and turned like 50 stomach aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came the three Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the six young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In came the housemaid with her cousin, the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend, the milkman. In came the boy from over the way, who was suspected of not having board enough for his master, trying to hide himself behind the girl from next door but one, who was proved to have had her ears pulled by her mistress. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully, some awkwardly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came, anyhow and everyhow.
Oh, is it beautiful?
You get a beautiful kind of train of people there. And what you get a sense of there is that not everyone would be welcome all year round. There's the boy who's not going to pay his rent at the end of the month. But the point is, for this one day, they kind of reserve all judgment and just throw the doors open.
I think that might be an ancient thing too, when, you know, the day when debts are forgiven and people sort of make up around the fire.
This is the big problem we had in COVID, was that we had this tussle between landlords and renters about whether they would suspend the rent. So maybe they should have taken a leaf out of Fezziwig's book.
They should be more charitable. Something that does worry me about the modern era is this sort of attack on fire. Not all environmentalists, because there's a big debate about this wood business. But, you know, future generations might say, you know, there was a puritanical attack on fire. People weren't allowed to have fires or have bonfires or anything because they were worried about that. So they had to sort of gather around a radiator.
And in this a crisis of energy, the one thing that we could kind of all do with at the moment is an open fire in our homes, but we've had them all taken away.
Another Christmas tradition, which is seen in some quarters as sort of vulgar, is that thing where people decorate their house with loads and loads of lights. You know, and there's this absolute explosion of like electric light all over the house, and they have
like Blackpool illuminations style.
Like Blackpool illuminations, and George Monbiot sort of bicycles past on his like whatever, you know, bicycle. It's like outrageous sort of waste of energy, you know. But that's a bit sort of anti-fun because, you know, that's in the tradition of the old Christmas again, because
Scrooge.
It's dark outside, so let's light up.
For the people on the street as much as for your own.
For the people on the street,
it actually faces outward,
not the Christmas tree here, it's, you know, and everything's dead. So it's obviously natural to bring greenery inside.
Our Christmas tree is actually a little bit dead.
It's quite dry back there.
I think the Christmas tree was a German invention. But the idea of bringing, you know, holly and ivy into the house in the middle of the winter is ancient.
Which is another inversion, isn't it? It's the, you know, the top becomes the bottom and the outside becomes the inside. So it's sort of mixing it up. Victorians we were on, Dickens. You need to help me here. Are the Victorians then sort of reimagining the more cheerful, merry Christmas? Because we often think of Victorians as actually quite severe and moralistic. Which way did that go then by the end of Victoria's reign?
No, I think it turned into our Christmas, you know, and things became much more Christmassy at Christmas.
But were they wild and sort of carnival-like atmosphere, the Victorians? I think of the grand Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And Dickens also retains a sort of quite moralistic attitude. Were they having wild parties for Christmas, the Victorians, do we think?
It wasn't quite as good as the medieval Christmas, because it was only one day off. Well, like, you know, Bob Cratchit gets half a day off originally, doesn't he, on Christmas Day? And that was because of the factory system and the, you know, new capitalism.
I'm going to try to answer my own question there. It was a bit of a cheat, because there's a clip that I really want us to play from one of my favourite movies, which is Fanny and Alexander, which is a Swedish film by Ingmar Bergman. And it's not actually Victorian. I think that it's set in the kind of maybe this Edwardian or sort of 1910 kind of time, but it is very Victorian. And there's this amazing, very grand apartment in Uppsala, unbelievably bedecked with over-the-top Victorian Christmas decorations. There's the whole family coming together for the party. And I think maybe this clip captures that combination of kind of merriment with plenty. Let's have a look. So that clip, I think, maybe captures that contrast a little bit. It's very Victorian and proper in a way, and the place is very decorated and it's affluent and it's sort of there's the whole family, there's the matriarch present, the kind of grandmother who's presiding over the whole thing. But then the lascivious uncle is going after one of the servant girls. People are getting up to no good in amongst the chaos. And maybe that was the sort of atmosphere.
This is where Dickens comes in again, because it's the return of the child. It's like the return to your original positions within the family. You see, Bergman does that there, that all of the children are kind of lined up in age order. And they, even though some of them are now adults, they've returned to this kind of state of childhood wonder and awe, which are the other words that, along with merry and jolly, go along with the kind of festive period. And I think maybe Dickens has something to say there about the family element of Christmas, but also the chaos that your family bring when you go back and you revert to your childhood self.
People are a bit scared of that, aren't they? Regressing and having, you know, family fights and things. But have
we been made to be scared of that? Because now every single kind of therapeutic article says, well, don't go back to your family for Christmas because you'll start behaving like a six-year-old again. I mean, maybe we should.
That's the whole point. Yeah, just embrace it. Just be a six-year-old again. And I think that's the point that if we can move on a little in the chronology.
We may.
To Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton. He was a sort of Catholic apologist and a bit of a medievalist. And he wrote a lot about Christmas in the sort of, I suppose, 1920s, 10s, that sort of period. And for him, it really should be about play. Oh, we should actually, can I just rewind back to Victorian? Because one thing, of course, that Victorians did is massively commercialised Christmas. They invented the Christmas cards. They turned it into a sort of, you know, it was such a commercial age. Everyone was on the make and lots of money was being made and fortunes made, fortunes lost. So they developed this whole thing where, you know, Christmas gifts had been given, I think I'm right to say, more at New Year. There had been a tradition of giving gifts, but it's more like an orange. It wasn't like, they weren't particularly sort of elaborate or...
Is that what you'll be giving
a fatted cape on?
Yeah. So excuse you give. BP Service Social Flowers.
If they're lucky.
So what did G.K. Chesterton have to say then?
Chesterton was very much, this is about playfulness. And he said also it should be about doing nothing, idling. But he said he liked it, writing in these sort of paradoxes. You know, Christmas is the time for doing nothing and people prepare for it by being incredibly busy. So he said, you know, this rushing about, bustling on trams and, you know, you can imagine it, the sort of bustle in 1910, 1920, the shopping that was going on, getting ready for Christmas and so on.
So true of today, though. You get people
exactly
saying,
like today,
God, I'm so stressed. About this period that I'm going to be relaxed in. Like, they get so worried about the perfect Christmas day that's going to be entirely relaxing that it almost nukes the whole thing.
Well, that's what's gone wrong, isn't it? That there's this sort of Instagram-y perfectionism. That everything's got to be sort of perfectly done. And oh, God, it's going to be a massive sort of headache and hassle, which may be a result of nuclear families. I mean, maybe in medieval period you had bigger households and certainly Victorian times.
Well, certainly more children. That means more cousins and more second cousins and all of that.
More people to share the work, you know. And, you know, we disapprove of it morally now, but, I mean, these Victorian households, you know, even quite a sort of modest household, like a doctor's household, had, like, a cook and a maid and an undermaid and a parlour maid or whatever, you know. So everyone was sort of, you know, many hands make light work.
So what do you think, Tom, that we should sort of conclude from this? For we're now, I'm going to allow us to go to the present now. You know, we're in this weird time now where a lot of these festivals have lost connection to where they originally came from. There's the normal sort of yearly controversy about cancelling Christmas, and we're not allowed to say Happy Christmas, we have to say Happy Holidays, all of those things which literally happen every single year. And there does feel a little bit like people aren't sure what they're supposed to be doing. So what's your Christmas message then? If I'm sitting at home watching this on the 23rd of December, what is the sermon from the Idler from Tom is what?
I think the sermon from the Idler is very simply, be very merry. It's a time for merrymaking, whatever your sort of cultural background. Every year, as you say, Freddie, there's this story that, you know, have you heard Birmingham Council wants to rename it Winterville, which apparently is not true. That never, ever happened. It's a sort of, apocryphal story. But I think it's great to call it Christmas. It's a time for freedom, for doing what you want, for not working, for mucking around, for being silly and being completely free.
And not feeling guilty about it. Because actually, the message is there's a sort of moral argument for mixing things up.
Exactly. So, you know, it's actually morally good to eat, drink and be merry.
So last year, I think we did quite a serious Christmas special, which was all about putting the Christ back into Christmas. I think that was the headline. Well, this year we are putting the merry back into Christmas. Thanks to Tom Hodgkinson at The Idler and thanks to you for tuning in. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.